Okay, so thank you very much. I'm Lubos Mitas from the North Carolina State University. I would like to thank the organizers for making an effort to organize this workshop and for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. And today I would like to talk about the work which we have been doing for a while. And it's on the quantum Monte Carlo calculations of electronic structure of materials. These might not be necessarily materials which we can call strongly correlated, but nevertheless, there will be a little bit of an issue about how to treat many-body effects and electronic correlation. Okay, so what's the motivation? I do interact with experimentalists from time to time. And what is becoming kind of interesting in the field is that each time you talk to them, they might come up with something different than a year ago. So it seems that materials are proliferating in various directions. For example, you get lots of multi-component systems, very complex compounds. You get a variety of boundary conditions or special geometries like dots, layers, and interfaces. You might encounter lots of DOF elements in there, and the systems might be neither usual solid or the molecule. It might be something like which we call nanoclusters, or there might be a mixture of solids and organics on the surface. And of course, the systems are of interest, and the effects of the interest are becoming more and more quantum. So if you take all these into account, it's a little bit difficult to find a unifying theory. For example, you don't have a clean solid where you can use the periodicity, or you don't have just the molecule where you basically can count everything one by one. And so the idea is actually to try to see whether we can do something which would work for a whole bunch of these systems at the same time. And of course, one of the approaches we know, these are the approaches based on basically functional theory. They can be basically universally applied to all those systems. It doesn't mean necessarily that they would be successful, but they are sufficiently general to be applicable to all of them. Today I would like to talk about the alternative method, and the focus will be zero temperature, and we will keep the space continuous exactly as it is formulated within the Schrödinger picture. So we have the system of interacting electrons and ions in continuous space, and we would like to get some information about the ground state of the electronic system, and then possibly about excited states, maybe even optical properties, later responses to external fields, and so on. And since many-body effects often hold a key, we'd like to look a little bit beyond the traditional approaches. And by traditional approaches, I mean something like a density functional or similar methods. And of course, one of those alternatives is quantum Monte Carlo. Before I go into quantum Monte Carlo, let me just do a little bit of a distinction here. Most of the traditional approaches, with some exception in quantum chemistry for small systems, are based on one and two particle quantities: one particle density, one particle density matrix, one particle Green's function, and so on. And the reason is, of course, we know why. Because these contain just the right amount of information to get the physics out. If we know one particle and two particle density matrix, we can evaluate any one or two particle operators, and then we know essentially everything. And basically, and in some sense, this is actually, this picture is imprinted on the students from the very beginning. They say everything is in density of states and one particle Green's function, and so on and so forth. And it's perfectly right. On the other hand, QMC is based on wave functions, and of course, immediately there is a number of objections which can be raised. The basic one, the wave functions are too complicated and intractable and contain too much of information which is actually irrelevant. Corresponding equations like Schrödinger equation, its origin of formation is almost impossible to solve. Limiting the large number of particles might not be well defined, and we know well the argument. And the last point is, of course, it's difficult to understand the physics, since the physics, under physics, we understand all the one particle or two particle properties. Once we know those, we know everything. I would say that, okay, I keep these objections in mind, and we'll see what we can do despite of those. So we'll start with the wave functions, and the most often used wave functions in QMC are Slater-Gistow type of wave functions. So we start from something like you would do in quantum chemistry. It's just a linear combination of products of spin up and spin down Slater determinants built from one particle orbitals. And one particle orbitals, well, we can generate them in any of these theories, like Hartree-Fock, multi-configurational Hartree-Fock, density functional theory produces orbitals as well, even if need not to, but it gives one particle orbitals from which you can build Slater determinants. The departure from the traditional picture is somewhere here, at least on the variational level. We simply say, if we know that the wave function has a special property at a certain place, and we know that because, for example, when two electrons of unlike spins go through each other, we know that the wave function should have a special functional form. And that special functional form is called electron-electron cusp, and it can be easily proved what it is, because in the Schrödinger equation, the energy is finite, so on one side you have a finite value, and on the other side you have diverging electron-electron potential and kinetic energy that has to cancel, and you know the functional form because that's the dominant term at that place. So, what we do is actually we build those properties which we know about directly into the wave function simply by using some proper functional form. And its concrete form is not that important. Here we have terms which depend on the distances between the electrons and distances between the electrons and ions. And actually we have also triple electron-electron-ion types of correlations, which are the next most important after electron-electron correlations. Okay, so these CKLM coefficients we can consider them to be a variational parameters. Now, of course, there is no way how we can back to the old methods how to evaluate any expectation value, because the traditional methods at one place or another always boil down to the product of one particle orbitals, because this is the only way how you can evaluate many dimensional integral by products of low dimensional integrals. But we claim that this is a general complicated function, and we simply can't do that factorization anymore. So the way how to evaluate any expectation value is to sample the space of electron configurations randomly and use the property that, for example, if we want to evaluate the energy, it can be written in this form, and then we can evaluate the quantity which is called local energy H psi over psi using samples which are distributed according to the psi t squared. You see that here you can interpret it as a probability density. Of course, if H psi over psi, if psi would be exact, this would be an eigenvalue, and we would need just single sample to get the value. Of course, it is never exact. So what you get is some varying function, and you take an average of that, and that's the estimation of the variational energy.
I don't understand the ratio. What's H psi is a function?
That's right.
So you have a ratio of?
Of two functions.
Of all variables.
That's right. These depend on all electronic variables, three n coordinates.
You need to get a number from there.
That's right. H psi is a function, so I divide this function by this function.
At a particular point.
At a particular point. This is R sample. That's the same point. So these are just numbers then. It's some function. It should be a constant, it should be an eigenvalue, but it is not, because simply we never construct completely exact wave function except a few electron problems. And once you know how to evaluate the energy, you can evaluate the other quantities. For example, you can evaluate the variance of the energy. It's actually an advantage to do that, because then you can use to minimize this property, to minimize the variance of the local energy, which of course should be also zero if the wave function would be exact, to optimize the variance parameters. Of course, you could do that also by minimizing the energy, but this is bounded from below for any particular, you know, configurations of electrons. But this quantity might not be always bounded well for a particular position of electrons. So you could easily go beyond, below, or get large fluctuations. Well, this is always bounded from below by zero. So it's more stable actually to use the second order moment instead of first order moment to optimize the variational parameters. Variational Monte Carlo, and I will talk about the numbers a little bit later, is a very straightforward and simple method, and it's actually pretty fast and efficient. It has two difficulties. The accuracy is usually not enough. Simply by hand, it's very difficult, or by combination of hand and a machine in this case, it's difficult to get enough accuracy. And there is also a variational bias. If you are comparing two completely different systems, it's very difficult to guarantee that the functional form for the wave function which you use and number of variational parameters and all the pieces which are in there will be such that if you do the energy difference, which is usually what we are interested in, you can guarantee that the bias will cancel out. It usually doesn't cancel out, and you have essentially something which depends on your functional form, and basically you have the usual problem of variational bias. Now, it is possible to eliminate large part of the variational bias by using the projector method. Essentially, we take the exponentiated Hamiltonian as a projector and apply it on the trial function. And the time here is imaginary, so that we can get exponentially fast convergence towards the ground state. This is nothing else but just rewritten in the imaginary time Schrödinger equation, and this is the same thing in the integral form. Now, wave function can be sampled exactly as in the variational Monte Carlo, and then the corresponding Green's function, which is nothing else but matrix element of the exponentiated Hamiltonian, can be considered a transition probability density. And then you basically use it to evolve. You plug in delta functions, which are the sampling points here, propagated by tau, and you get the wave function in t plus tau. You iterate it until the long imaginary time, and exponentially you should converge to the ground state. The trouble is that kind of implicitly we assume that the wave function is always positive, because we interpreted the Green's function as a transition probability. But that works, of course, only for non-negative distribution, and we know that the wave function will be both positive and negative. And there are various ways how to get around it. One, we could do a little bit of an attempt to use naive approach. Well, how about if we divide the wave function into positive and negative p's and plug it in back to the Schrödinger equation? Because the Schrödinger equation is, of course, linear, it decomposes into two equations. And you can start to evolve plus and minus components independently. And of course, what happens is that it always goes to the ground state, and the ground state in this case is fermionic state, as one can easily prove that the bosonic state will be always below fermionic. So they will both converge towards the towards the bosonic state. And in the large time limit, if you do the difference of those two essentially independently evolved pieces of the wave function, the fermion signal dies out exponentially quickly. Or the phone, of bosonic noise. So the bosonic noise takes over exponentially fast. That's a fundamental problem which we have to deal with. Yes?
Can you explain again the decomposition between...
Mm-hmm. Maybe I should draw it I will steal a little bit of thunder what Matthew wanted to talk yesterday, but nevertheless. Let's suppose that we have something like a wave function like this. This is plus part, this is minus part. Okay, this is like a first excited state in a box, but it's a good model for a Fermionic problem because it has two pieces. Now, let's suppose that we take this, and this will be psi plus. Let's suppose that we take this will be psi minus. Okay, and let's try to evolve that. What will happen? This guy will evolve to this, and of course this guy will evolve to these two, once we release the constraint. So they both will go to the ground state, which is the bosonic state, and the difference will disappear exponentially fast. And the reason is that plus and minus are completely independent. There is absolutely no restriction. They don't speak with each other. If you have a fixed functional form and you evaluate the expectation value, it's able to speak constrained, but a fixed functional form. But the samples here are not constrained at all.
They're both determinants, or not?
No, these are just points in a 3N dimensional space.
But the boundary condition is usually plus the differential equation what determines the solution.
That's right, so but that's a perfect question. You say boundary condition, but we have no boundary condition in the beginning. We have only anti-symmetry condition. And anti-symmetry is no local. You know, when two electrons are here and I put them there, it has to be minus. But where is the zero between? We have no idea. It is somewhere in between. I move those two electrons from this position to that position. Somewhere I hit the zero, but I have no idea where. So I don't know boundary conditions. I know only symmetry conditions. Boundary condition has a huge advantage that it is local, and that's actually the topic of the next view graph, and the way how to get around the problem with the so-called fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo.
So that I understand.
Yes.
What guarantees that if you start from something which is psi plus is positive?
Yes.
Psi minus is positive.
That's right.
But how will you guarantee that it remains positive in the propagation under the Hamiltonian?
Because the transition probability is positive. Because for an ordinary Hamiltonian, well, there are cases where it is not the case. But when you have a local Hamiltonian, by local I mean there is only kinetic energy, potential energy is by definition local, and kinetic energy in a small time step, you can always go with the limit of the time step that is sufficiently small that it will be local, and it has to be. It is not the case for non-local Hamiltonians. When you have, for example, effective core potential, pseudo potentials, or something like that, that's not the case. You can get off-diagonal elements which will be not positive, and then you get a different type of problem. For local Hamiltonians, it is always Green's function, exponentiated Green's function is always positive.
Or in other words, the ground state is always nodeless for these Hamiltonian ground state.
That's right, because it's a bosonic ground state, that's right. But you can have a bosonic ground state for non-local Hamiltonians as well, still the Green's function will not be positive everywhere. So, as I have learned from you 11 years ago, right? So that's the point. For local Hamiltonians, everything works nice. Because one can show it very easily if you expand it to my th, it's something like 1 minus th. And if you evaluate the expectation value of r and r prime, you always get a negative. So the whole thing will be positive. And if it is positive at small time, it will be positive always, because you can always decompose this into smaller and smaller time slices, and it's still product of the same quantity. So if the quantity is positive at tiny time t everywhere, it will stay positive always, because all the products will be positive. So,
is it possible that by decomposition, you will introduce some kind of spatial singularity when you apply the Hamiltonian to the wave function?
Not really. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's the problem. I would like to move a little bit. I knew that that would generate the discussion, but that's the idea of the workshop, to get the understanding through. But for the moment, I would like to move on, and we can, of course, continue as much as you wish, perhaps after the talk. So what we do is the thing that we don't know how to project well anti-symmetric wave functions, because simply the plus and minus workers are independent, and so they all converge towards the bosonic state. Well, let's introduce the important sampling with the trial function to improve the efficiency of the whole process. And it improves the efficiency of the whole process enormously. And basically what we do, we just multiply the Schrödinger equation by psi t. And what we get here will be the product of psi t and our function, which we are looking for. And the Green's function will be modified accordingly. We reweight with the trial function. And now we are ready to introduce the so-called fixed node approximation, which is the following one. The trial function has somewhere zero. When we exchange two electrons like this, somewhere in between is zero. And we call that place where it is zero, it's actually 3n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface if we have n electrons in three-dimensional space. We call that zero fermion node. Okay. And we enforce the following condition. We enforce the fermion node of our solution, say psi ground or psi zero or phi zero, to be identical to the fermion node of the trial function. And that's the key point here, that we exchange actually anti-symmetry for boundary condition. Anti-symmetry is non-local, boundary condition is perfectly local. I always know on which side I am. The wave function is either positive or negative, and I can always evaluate whether it's positive or whether it's negative. Okay, once I introduce this, the sign problem is gone, because then the product of those two functions is always larger than zero. They share common boundary conditions, so their product will be always non-negative. Okay, and so as I said, we replace the condition which was non-local by the condition which is local, and of course there is a leap of the faith here, because we don't have, in the beginning, a good feeling how good or how bad the approximation is. And let me just tell you that it's an excellent approximation in general, and I will talk about the numbers and reasons why it is so good towards the end, after I give a few examples what the method can do. And so, let me just briefly say that the key points. We work directly in 3n dimensional space, where n is the number of electrons. And we use rather stochastic rather than basis function representation. In some sense, you can consider these to be a stochastic basis set, if you want, because this is essentially what it is. And we built up on the one-particle methods of any kind, but at some point when they start to lose the steam, we go beyond with the genuine many-body things. And it's computationally demanding, but it can be done for realistic systems. First, I will start with something from the middle 90s, which was the calculation of the lowest energy isomers of carbon 20. After carbon 60 was discovered, it was, of course, a lot of speculations that this might not be the smallest possible carbon cage type of system. And actually, the smallest one might be carbon 20 in this dodecahedron structure. But there were other isomers which were competitive in energy. This was like something like a piece of C60 taken out. You see a pentagon and around the hexagons. And also dimerized ring. And what was interesting was that when people did this within the DFT calculations, here, for example, we have just the plain LDA. And this is the energy difference between those isomers. So the lowest was the cage here, and it was always relative to the lowest one. So the lowest was the cage, about one electron was this ball structure, and the ring was about four electrons above. Interestingly enough, if they took some of those generalized gradient approximation, in this particular case, this was Beckley-Young power, you got just the opposite. Well, Oz was the ring, there was the ball, and by 4 electron volts was the cage. And it was actually not that far from hyperfog in this case. And if you took other GGAs, it was somewhere between these two. It was like you could get almost any ordering between those two which you want. And so we did kind of several calculations. At that time we had just hyperfog geometries, and we actually kept them for the reason to have a comparison with previous attempts, including quantum chemistry calculations. Yes?
In those calculations, do you remember if you did LDA calculations and GGA calculations just for one of those structures, relax the atoms, were the structures the same?
Yeah, the structures are the same. They have a reasonable gate in this case. They are well bounded, and the changes were minimal. There were some bond length changes, but not dramatic ones. There is a little bit of an issue here on this ring, which I can mention a little bit later, because there is a dimerization here, and it's a little bit sensitive on the dimerization because it's tenfold type symmetry. So if you change the dimerization, the effect multiplies by 10. So you can get a little bit of a movement in the energy here. But it was not the key point at this moment. So we did the diffusion Monte Carlo fixed node calculations here, and we actually got the lowest ball, and the highest was the cage. And the ring was about 1 electron volt from those. Interestingly enough, after our calculations, and it kind of caught attention because everybody said, well, DFT for SP systems is basically safe. It just predicts it almost always. Right, and there is nothing to discover in there. And so we thought also that there is nothing to discover, but that was this project was brought to our attention by a quantum chemist, Krishna Raghavachary from AT&T Bellet, who wrote parts of the Gaussian big quantum chemistry package, who actually asked us for the help, which is not usual. Chemists usually don't ask physicists for help. It was very interesting, and I actually got lots of responses on this. People just didn't believe it, that it's not okay, and it is not possible, and so on. After that, two groups independently confirmed these results exactly for the same conditions. We actually put the structures on the web, energies on the web, basis sets which we used, everything. So actually, two groups independently got it, like Friesner. He used some quantum chemistry method I can't reproduce. The acronym has about 20 letters or something like that. So anyway, he reproduced basically the results which we got. And another group did QMC calculations, but we used effective core potentials. They used all electrons, including core electrons. These were huge calculations. They confirmed everything within 10th of an electron volt. So it was a little bit interesting because we felt that there is no other method which could give us this interesting independent information. And of course, from that time, we ran through a bunch of other problems. For example, this is like a quantum chemistry problem. Cyclooctatetraene is nothing else but C8H8. So it's like a benzene, but the ground state structure is not flat like in the case of the benzene, but it's actually kind of a inverse tab or something like that. And actually, the flat structure is the transition state between the flipping of from this orientation to that orientation. And if you look on this transition state, which is actually very interesting, you get there two degenerated orbitals and two possible electrons to fill those orbitals. So you can have either singlet or triplet coupling. And if you look on the methods, they will all give you that the triplet is the lowest one. But if we do a very accurate calculations in DMC, actually the singlet is the lowest one. So actually it's almost like a benzene type of a pi electron current or whatever it is. Yes?
Just one question. Maybe I would have thought that the chair conformation, the transition to the chair conformation is actually the transition state. Did you check whether the chair configuration is stable or stays around?
This one? You mean this one?
No, if you...
This one, whether it's a...
You're flipping both at the same time, you go through a flat structure.
I okay.
I would think that you flip one side and then you flip the other, and this is probably more efficient.
This is... this might be more efficient, but the reason why we chose this one was that they had an experiment, and it was very accurate experiment actually on this one, so the energy was known.
What was the experiment?
This was a photoelectron detachment. It's in this science paper. It was actually the largest molecule on which the transition state was actually measured. That was the interesting part.
So this thing is metastable.
That's right. This is perfectly metastable. It's flipping from this one to that one, and it goes through a transition state with at least.
It has a transition state between D2D and D8H. So D8H is not the transition state.
Yeah, it is the transition state.
This is the transition state. Because the experiment cannot say. They cannot observe. How do you observe it?
That's the point of the whole experiment, that they were able to observe it through photoelectron detachment. That was basically the idea. That's the reason why it made it to science, because it was the largest transition state which they were able to observe, and they were actually able to extract the height of the barrier. That was the interesting part. That was exactly the reason why we have chosen that. It was a pretty unique experiment, by the way. They had various tricks how to actually nail that state down within the lifetime of the measurement which they do.
So when you say to nail the state down, including the configuration?
That's right. That's right.
That's pretty astonishing.
Yeah, I was astonished as well.
So this was femtosecond spectroscopy.
Exactly. And the point was that within the experiment, we agree within the error bar. And actually, the lowest state is really singlet. It's not triplet. And
this is in electron volts?
No, this is in kilocal per mole. So it's like tenth of electron volt. These are small differences, of course, but of course they matter in chemistry, right? Let's get into the exponential for the transition rate. Another interesting case, which we did fairly recently, has also to do with the carbon, and the problem was the following. If we take 4N plus 2, where N is a natural number, carbon rings, we have an interesting system with the Hooker rule fulfilled. So there is a nicely filled shells, and it has a large gap. Still, there are possibilities of the following isomers. We have either cumulonic isomers, where all the bond lengths and bond angles will have the same values, or we have the angle-alternated isomer, where we have smaller, larger, smaller, larger, or we have the bond length alternated isomer, dimerized, shorter, longer, shorter, longer. Where is this dimerization coming from? Well, if you look on the electronic structure of the cumulonic one, what you get is the following. Here is two degenerated HOMOs and two degenerated LUMOs of the same symmetry. So, and you get a large gap. Interestingly enough, if you go to large rings, you get something else. Sigma band is doubly occupied, but then you have pi x and pi y bands, which are singly occupied. So you get a semi-metal. And it's a one-dimensional system, and we know from Pyle's argument that there should be a gap opening by some distortion. And of course here you still can think about the other type of distortion, which is coming from the second order antenna. There's no first order antenna, of course, because it's a field shell. But the second order antenna is possible. You still have a gate, but still those excitations can mix with the ground state, and they could cause a second order antenna distortion. And so the question is how the gate develops as the size increases. And you could strikingly different perspectives from GGA type of calculations and Hartree-Fock type of calculations. GGA, of course, we know it's built on the paradigm of the homogeneous electron gas is heavily used in there, and the system biases towards more homogeneous cases. Namely, it doesn't show dimerization, And it's up to very large sizes. There was a work by Bilaska and others who claimed that there is a tiny dimerization at the very end, which would kind of correspond to Pyle's mechanism. We didn't see it, but anyway, it's not that important at this point. On the other hand, with Hartree-Fock, already for small sizes, even C14, you get a huge dimerization gap, which is giant. I mean, the difference between the gaps is pretty nicely visible here. This is from Hartree-Fock above, and you see the dimerized just keeps the gap, and the axis here is 1 over n, where n is the number of atoms in the ring. So as you go to infinity, this just keeps a huge gap here, the dimerized case. The angle alternative kind of dies out after a while because you just can't create that structure with otherwise you would get into the zigzag type of a structure. And with GFT, it just goes to zero. So we did the calculations, and to make a long story short, I'll just say what is the summary. So cumulonic versus alternated. Alternated geometries are favored at all sizes. And the cumulonic isomer is always a transition state between shifting the dimerization either in angle or bond one side along the ring. Okay? And what is interesting that angle alternated versus bond length alternated or dimerized isomer, there is a crossover between C10 and C14. So it happens at very low sizes, actually. And gap is then present at all sizes, and you have a smooth evolution from the second order antler, which is dominant at the small sizes, into something like a Pyle's regime. When the ring is long, you don't know what that is, whether it's second order antler or Pyle's. It's the same thing. And what is interesting is that for carbon 10, the difference between those three isomers is of the order of 0.1 electron volt. So the energy surface is almost flat, and that's the region where it goes from one type of alternation to the other type of alternation. And then the bond length alternation just wins because it's the only one which is energetically favorable at large sizes. And it's kind of an interesting study where you can do from small systems up to very large systems, and you can get the basic information out. Another project, how much time do I have? Well, maybe I should move on faster. Okay, I'll just want to show a little bit of the work on nanocrystals and why are nanocrystals interesting. Well, they are optically very very attractive materials. In particular, I'm working with a group at Illinois, and they construct, they were able to build the experiment which produces a lot of high quality of these nanocrystals. They are hydrogen saturated on the surface. They are very small and optically extremely active. It seems that it's the most strongly luminescent materials which is known, or is competing with the best luminescent materials. And here's a kind of flasks with it. Professor Neifeck, who is doing the experiment at Illinois, was showing the system actually at the APS meeting. Here, the tiny ampule like this, in a quarter of a watt UV laser, and he shined on it right in the room. And from that small flask, you could see the light through a room about 10 times bigger than this one. So the luminance is extremely well. And there's a lot of interest. I think that he filed for 4 or 5 patents on that. And there was quite a lot of search for various types of isomers which could be think of. This was the one where we wanted to reproduce the blue luminescent case, and we played with various surface reconstructions and things like that. And for actually estimating the correct thing, we looked on the gap here. This is just an estimated gap from Homo-Lumo calculations. And after that, we actually also wanted to see whether we can reproduce something beyond that, which was optical absorption. The experiment was not particularly great. It was only a relatively narrow energy window. And after we did all the trials with various systems, we were able to reproduce the optical absorption. Of course, we didn't calculate really the optical absorption by QMC here. This is just a configuration interaction singles. These are broadened peaks. by about 10th of an electron volt. The only thing in KMC what we did here was actually to correct the size of the gap. CI gives reasonable ordering of the state. It's not perfect, but the biggest error which you get is actually the position of the absorption edge. That's the biggest error which you get on the CI. Once you correct that, then it looks reasonable, and within the resolution of experiment and what we were able to get, we consider that to be a good agreement.
How do you get the direct absorption edge from QMC?
You calculate the energy of the no. You calculate the energy of the exciton exactly like in the experiment.
So you have a ground state.
You take a ground state. You do the excited state. Do the difference, and you basically you have the energy of the exciton. Okay. One can go beyond that. We tried actually to calculate the Stokes shift since it was interesting. Well, you know what's going on in a Stokes shift. It absorbs, relaxes the structure a little bit, emits, and relaxes back into the ground state. And the point was that some people argued for years actually that the exciton which gets in there gets self-trapped. And the mechanism for self-trapping was that, well, it then concentrates on one of those bonds, it breaks the bond, and then because the bond is broken, it has a hard time actually to get out. We actually found that this is not the case. The exciton, well, this is a one particle representation of the excited state, of course, was actually distributed across the whole cluster. And it ended up with the bond length changes, which were of the order of only 1/100th of an angstrom. So there was almost nothing going on structurally here. It was all distributed across the whole thing. And just because the number of atoms was large, that was the reason why you could get the appreciable Stokes shift. And once we did the calculations of the Stokes shift with various methods, we got actually pretty good agreement with the usual LDA, GGA type of calculations. And why we got the agreement between those? Well, if you think about what is the Stokes shift, it's essentially one energy difference minus the other energy difference. So you do multiple energy differences, and basically all the systematic effects already cancel out, and you get actually a pretty clean number from just from DFT, even if it is just an excited state. And of course it's the excited state in the sense that you calculate a sequence of total energies. So in the double energy difference, we got a nice agreement. But of course it was great to have a confirmation with independent method to understand that this is actually working. Okay. Now, let me mention a little bit about the solids. I think Matthew might cover it perhaps tomorrow. Solids are, of course, what we do with the solids. It's a supercell with periodical boundary conditions, with all the difficulties which this method actually has. So. We have finite size effects, and the finite size effects might be different in the kinetic energy, namely sampling of the K points, potential energy, cell shape, and actually the Cambridge group and Matthew did a lot actually to distinguish these two and reanalyze them and actually try to correct that.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
How do you do the Ewald sum? I mean, you need to know the charge density then.
No, you have a point charges.
So it's not like the hard trade for the Ewald.
You have point charges because you have the original Hamiltonian, so that's just a matter of calculation. But there are.
If you're doing a cluster, right, and sort of embedded in a solid, then in the next unit cell, it's the charge density of the reproduced cluster.
No, if you have a supercell plus periodic boundary condition, it's just a repeat. So it's just a. So it's just the pretty much standard. In this sense, this is just a classic Ewald sum because it's just the potential energy. And of course, what we actually tried to do was that besides the cohesive energies, we're trying to study the band structures. And we introduced something which I called band structure scan. suppose that this is we have a, this is like an example of diamond. This is the diamond band structure, and these black dots are occupied states within the given size of the supercell. Now, how to get the position of the conduction band, for example? Well, let's take this gamma electron from the top of the valence state and let's put it into this one particle state. What you create is it's something like an artificial exciton. I mean, it's not genuine exciton because there are many caveats to it. Namely, the supercell is finite, so the natural size of the exciton might be more distributed. It might not be well described by a single particle excitation. There might be some region of the key points around it to create the wave function. Nevertheless, it's not such a bad approximation for the exciton here. And you calculate one total energy for the ground state and the other total.
Excuse me, just to understand your
words. Yes.
You say you take an electron.
Yes. That's right.
So, are you saying you're creating an independent electron and independent hole?
That's right. Or.
And you're saying that's not so different from an exciton. Or, that's what I couldn't
grab. Well, that's kind of an artificial exciton, I would say.
No, it's an artificial independent electron hole.
Yeah.
Well, that's not an exciton.
They interact.
But they do interact.
Yeah, but that's not an exciton.
They're confined within the small little simulation cells, so they're stuck together by the fact that they can't escape. Yeah,
so we see here a band structure, right, which is appropriate for an infinite. Yes. So I'm just trying to understand, what is your mental image? Is your mental image that you're creating an electron and a hole, yes, interacting, but if they are spread all over an infinite crystal, of course,
they will be different.
Independent electrons and holes, the interaction becomes negligible. Or are you talking about an exciton?
No, I'm talking about let's suppose that we just do the excitation, but we have a supercell which is finite. So we force those two actually to interact. Mm. And there is no escape because simply they are confined in that supercell.
Mm.
So,
yeah, but I mean, in that case, of course, you don't have a sharp distinction between exciton and hole.
No, that's right. That's right.
You have to be.
That's exactly right. No, that's the point that I say that it's artificial. Because I don't have that clear distinction. That's exactly right.
The good news is that the energy of interaction between the electron and the hole is a lot smaller than the
atom. Yeah, that's the point. But if you do the difference between the energy, you get a gap energy plus some electron-hole interaction. In this case, like a diamond.
If the interaction is much smaller than the gap, then you're talking about the limit of an infinite system. That's what you get in an infinite system. I was just trying to get a little more clarity. It didn't get much more clarity, but a little bit. Thank you.
Okay. So the point is that this energy within the supercell which we are using is small, even if we confine them and just try to evaluate. Yes?
Let me just reiterate on that question. I mean, if you would do now a supercell calculation where the supercell goes to infinite,
yes,
right? Wouldn't you in that case also get a real exciton where the states are localized in a region?
That depends on your construction, because exciton is not exactly like Professor Kohn pointed out. Exciton is not just the bare electron and a hole. This is still an independent system. Exciton is more, because of course you get more of the states included into that excitonic state if you want to localize it, otherwise they would fly through the crystal independently. That's exactly right. For that, you would need actually to construct the corresponding wave function. Wave function wouldn't be a single determinant then. So, if I would like to model a real exciton like it is in a solid, which is lattice constants, large, effectively, what you need to do is actually go beyond a single particle or single determinant picture. The wave function will not be a single determinant. It will be some linear combination of determinants from k points around it, and then you would start to get something like a real bounded exciton. Otherwise, you have exactly like Professor Kohn pointed out, independent electron and hole in one particle picture.
Okay, one last little question. What are the actual dimensions? What's the dimension on exciton? I think you're talking about diamond, presumably pretty small. And what is the dimension of your system?
The exciton in diamond, so we had, if we say a supercell of 64 atoms, we have about, the exciton is about twice as large. So we still artificially confine it. So we actually have more, a little bit larger this energy of electron hole interaction than it actually should be. We should still release the or go to a larger sizes, but it's difficult, of course, and it's very, very costly.
Let me ask you one question so I understand. If you had not the sign problem and you could, for each of the two cases, converge to the exact wave function numerically, then you would have the exciton in the infinite crystal. If you could in any way force it to be...
It's a slippery slope if you think about it that way. You might get some of those effects, but you then start to worry about the fixed node approximation.
Yeah.
Since the...
In principle, you have not determinants if you had the QMC results.
Because simply the proper wave function should be a linear combination of determinants, and if you don't have it, there is no guarantee that you will recover the proper picture.
I think it's worse than that. I think if you had no sign, you could do exact DMC, both wave functions would collapse to the ground state and your
acceleration would be zero.
Okay. Okay. Maybe I should just try to show one more example here about nanomaterials, which is kind of an interesting story, since I wanted to do actually a little bit more like a prediction instead of just reproducing the experiment. And in 94, I tried to play with the following system, because we were doing silicon clusters at that time. If you do the silicon in this icosahedron structure, you need two electrons to fill the electron shell. So I naively thought, how about putting a manganese in? Those will donate two electrons in there, and then we'll get nice localized large spin in the center. And of course, it didn't work that way. It hybridized and distorted, and everything was essentially not a stable system. What was interesting in Japan in 2001. We came from the laser ablation experiments of silicon with some salts with transition metals with the clusters which looked like this. And essentially this was silicon 12, and inside were tungsten, chromium, and some other elements. So I wasn't successful at that time, but it was shooting at least in the right part of the periodic table. And we started to study actually these, and started to put other transition metals, and we came out actually with kind of a nice picture that with even number of electrons, these are almost always singlets. With odd number of electrons, these are doublets, but the gaps are pretty sizable for the system like a silicon. So they should be, most of them should be actually very stable. There are exceptions like titanium and zirconium, where the singlet and triplet actually compete. And the reason why they compete is that there is a competition between the localized states on transition metals and the P states, which just hold together the whole cluster. And if you look at it, energetically, these states are coming very close. And it's very difficult, actually, to distinguish which one is the lowest one and whether it would be whether they would be stable and so on. So that's one of the systems on which we are working now. And now, perhaps, I should go... Yes?
I just came back from Japan, and they're doing some interesting and apparently fairly successful VFT calculations on
those systems.
Geometries.
Yeah, on many of those where it was clear that the singlet is okay or triplet is the ground state, it was fine. We didn't actually study those too much deeply because it came out nicely. But for several of those, the states were not very competitive. So that was the place where it was actually not perfectly predictive. Okay, so let me just summarize here with the following. So what we do is the wave function based things, and we believe that they can be applied to a large number of systems. And for at least for SP, we got kind of a nice collection of problems which we actually solved. And typically, what you get in variational Monte Carlo is about 85% of the correlation energy, where the correlation is measured. There's a difference between exact and Hartree-Fock. Hartree-Fock is sort of a reference level here. It's of the order of 3% of the total energy. So what we are getting some very nice accuracy there. Within the diffusion Monte Carlo, you get roughly 95% of the correlation. The fixed node error is typically about 5% of the correlation energy. And that seems to be the case for all the systems which we studied, starting from small molecules up to solid. And wow, this is kind of obvious. We are roughly 100 times, maybe a little bit more, slower than typical DFT with the most accurate methods which we use. And the error within the experiments, since within those 5% we always do some differences, are roughly 1 to 2% from experiments. Typically, the accuracy on which we shoot is about 1/10 of an electron volt, at least in SP systems. It might not be the case in transition metal systems because simply the correlation energies are significantly larger there. So 5% might be a large value still for the transition metal systems. We tried several of these and they look okay. We tried several more and they are. They might, and we see some difficulties. So maybe we can agree on the following. At least this, as I see, the stationary Schrödinger problem. Suppose that we decompose the correlation into two parts. One would be find the correct boundary conditions, and quite often few determinants or even one determinant might be very reasonable. And this is what chemists would call it non-dynamical correlation, but it's nothing else but just how many determinants you need to include into the wave function to get a reasonable first-order approximation. And this can be obtained within the usual methods fairly easily. Then you have the other part, which are the so-called bosonic correlations within the domains cut out by the fermion nodes. And those are all the electron-electron cusp, multiple collision points, all those many complicated stuff. Quantum chemists call it dynamical correlation, but it has nothing to do with the dynamics, actually. It's just to distinguish between that one. And those are very difficult to get by traditional approaches. Those are however trivial within quantum Monte Carlo. And if you combine both, and actually use the one particle methods only up to the point where they are still efficient, and they are pretty efficient to build the zero order approximation, then you get pretty productive method by combination of these two. Will you be interested in the reasoning why Hartree-Fock or multi-configuration nodes are reasonable? Hartree-Fock, well, at least my take on it. Now, I mean, other people have other interpretation. Hartree-Fock is a size-consistent theory, which means all the Green's function theories and stuff are size-consistent. But within the wave function theories, this is not a guaranteed property. So the size consistency means that the energy scales proportionally to the number of particles. So if you increase the system twice as much, the Hartree-Fock percentually still generates the same error. It implies that the correlation energy remains the same as the percentage of the total energy, which is just the restatement of the same thing. Now, it implies that the Hartree-Fock fermion nodes are size consistent as well, because any artificial node is energetically very costly. What do you do if you impose additional node? Well, you increase the energy a lot because you increase the curvature a lot. And so these three statements are essentially the same. Now, I think that it's possible to argue that it implies that the fixed node approximation is also size consistent. And the reason is that the best what you obtain in fixed node approximation is the best possible solution within the fixed boundaries, because you have otherwise complete variational freedom in the diffusion Monte Carlo within the boundaries. That implies that the percentage of recovered correlation energy should be constant for any system. And this is actually what we observe. We essentially get the same percentage of error for atoms, clusters, solids, anything where we were able independently to find the value of the correlation energy, either by alternative calculation or by combination with experiment. Okay, and there's the very last one. Take two on one and two particle quantities versus many body wave functions. It seems that in a number of cases, actually, and that's an interesting point, it is more efficient to do many particle calculations than try to build a better mean field. I know that this might sound strange, but this is actually true. It's simply, in some cases, there was no alternative which we could use to get the correct state or something. I would say that don't worry about the unnecessary information which is in the wave function. That's the machine's problem. Now, combination of variational trial functions and stochastic methods is quite effective for getting the high accuracy solution of the Schrödinger equation. So we are actually inching towards decreasing the exponent or cornering the exponential scaling of the exact method to a smaller and smaller percentage of the correlation energy. Well, we can say now that within 95% of the correlation energy, we have a parallel method. Within the last 5%, we still need an exponentially demanding method. And in some sense, I always get these questions, how would you transform the whole thing which you did into one particle picture so that we can learn something? And I usually turn it the other way around, and I say that physics and understanding can be equally well built into the many-body wave functions, or obtained, of course, from many-body wave functions. And sometimes, actually, the breakthrough is the wave function, BCS wave function, Bob Laughlin's wave function. These are the very fundamental points in developing a new physical picture. In some sense, when you are working with the wave functions, you are most intimately, so to speak, connected with that physical system. It might be it's some work, of course, but to do a high quality mean field is also a lot of work. So it depends. And of course, these approaches are not appropriate for everything. I didn't talk too much about any spectral functions or anything like that, and Matthew might talk about it a little bit more tomorrow. And I think that there's a limit of large number of particles is okay. I don't think that there is any fundamental problem, even if there is this fundamental argument that the overlap of the wave function with the exact wave function goes exponentially down with the number of particles. I don't think that that's the relevant quantity, because overlap of the wave function doesn't do anything. What is important is actually projection of that wave function into lower dimensional space, like one and two particle density matrix, because what you actually evaluate in the machine is expectation values of one and two particle density matrices. And those projections seem to be very accurate, and they are size consistent. Thank you very much for your attention.
Can you say something about how the expense of the calculation grows with another particle?
Yes. It essentially grows like a third power in the number of particles. This is a comparison of various methods in the amount of the correlation energy typically obtained, energy differences, scaling in the number of electrons and actual times for a particle system. This is from some years ago, but qualitatively it's the same thing. And what you have here is n to the third power plus some component of the n fourth power, but it wouldn't come out until we are at 10,000 electrons or something like that. We are still far away from it. It's a parallel, and third power is coming actually from the inversion of Slater determinant. Where is coming the n fourth power? That's another factor of n is there. If you think about it, that you want actually the total energy with fixed accuracy for increasing size of the system. Because the fluctuations are growing proportionally to the energy, you get another factor of n. So that's where the nth power, n to the fourth power comes. And you see in time, what is interesting that if you compare actually Hartree fog, which is just a one particle kind of more complicated than DFT computationally, the variation of Monte Carlo to get the reasonable error bar is essentially comparable in time. It's not much more demanding than, and you get 85% of the correlation energy basically for free. That's of course not enough to get all the energy differences right, because as I said, there is this bias, and the bias is dangerous. You never can guarantee that you optimize everything if you use the stochastic representation to do the optimization. That's very difficult to guarantee that you got the actual minimum. So what we do is actually to get sufficiently good minimum and then go to the DMC method, which is some variational property. And of course, like a quantum chemistry approaches, they blow up really fast and even get less of a correlation energy. But they mastered over the years a good basis set error cancellation, so they actually can get within less correlation energy, fairly decent energy differences. But it still blows up really fast.
Can you, from memory, tell us something about how GGAs would fit in that table?
How GGAs would fit in the table? They would go somewhere in between here with accuracy. They would be, you know, they would be linear scaling if you use the sufficiently large number of particles or n to the third power. So they would be somewhere here. And speed is, of course, unbeatable.
But the time is really not very different from LDA.
And time is essentially one on this table. Absolutely, it's the same thing.
Yes? Can you say a little more about these transition metal silicon nanoclusters? You mentioned, what are the main difficulties that LDA is encountering?
Because if you have the localized D states and the localized bonding states from P electrons on silicon, and they are very competitive energetically, yeah. So you can construct actually a number of states which can be both triplets, singlets, and different symmetries, because you run essentially into almost a degeneracy problem there. And it seems to be particle for titanium. We didn't see it for many other.
The differences between these various states is typically what?
It seems to be within a few tens of electron volts, so what we see for the moment. So like a half an electron volt, maybe 3/4 of an electron. We are not sure yet, because that's one of the things which we are working on right now.
It's all non-magnetic states of transition.
Well, you get triplet or doublet, like a low spin states. And the ones with an even number of electrons are nicely singlets. And they have large gaps, which is kind of surprising. I would never believe that it would do a large gap, but it does. Yes.
About the cumulates, do you know how the DFT calculations have been done? Because I'm suspecting that you have two metastable states, and it could easily be that if you are not careful, that you're trying just to find a symmetric minimum, right? You're not checking basically a large distortion to see whether there's not another.
In this sense, I think that we exhausted everything. We calculated directly the distorted states, tried to optimize within those, everything. It always ran away from that into the symmetric. Yeah. Yes.
You were mentioning non-Hartree fog nodes as BCS or laughing or things like that. So I would like to ask this question. Normally, to my knowledge, most, or if not all, of the calculations for realistic materials are done actually for the normal state.
That's right.
With Hartree fog nodes. And actually, also some of the systems which could be of interest here with F electrons and so on are not, have not been attacked. So maybe Matthew will say that, but with such a strong atomic bomb, we are still limited to relatively simple systems. So maybe in 2 days explain why, because I see many sort of intrinsic limitations which have not been overcome over the last 10 years, like concerning how to replace the core with an effective potential, or how to test nodes which are not slightly different from Parsifal nodes.
Well, I tried a few years ago to play with the manganese oxide. I actually got pretty far, but at the very end I ran out of energy and resources essentially to get everything nailed down into the error bars which I would like to present. So it's possible. The only thing is that with the transition metals, one thing is that you want to keep the, say in the third row, 3s and 3p electrons in the valence space. And the reason is that they have tails into the bonding region, and they are actually important once you start to talk about the DD bonding and stuff like that. Then if you keep 3s and 3p in the valence space, you get fairly large total energies. Those total energies essentially slow down everything by a significant factor. And then it just becomes simply expensive to do the calculations, at least within the quality of the wave function which we have now. So I think that the progress here will happen, it just takes a little bit more time than on simple SP systems. I think that we are pretty much in the same position as we were with the SP systems in the early 90s.
After DMC, can you calculate the energy variance also?
That's right. It's automatically calculated,
then,
yes.
Then the energy variance is reduced from Hartree-Fock in the order of 95% also?
That's essentially right. That's essentially right.
I see. So after DMC, you get just 5% of the variance?
5%. Variance by itself is decreased roughly by a factor of 3 variationally, okay, because that's the only decrease which you have, because in DMC you don't decrease anything. In DMC you just evaluate the integral. But in variationally you decrease the variance by a factor of 3, so square of the variance is decreased almost by a factor of 10.
Why are you squaring the variance? Square rooting makes more sense.
Pardon?
Square rooting the variance makes more sense than squaring.
Yeah, because it is the same dimension of the energy, but usually the difference is in the the sigma is too crude of a number. I mean, the energy is bounded from below by the variance, right?
Depends what you mean by squaring.
So how is it scale with the system size?
What? The variance?
The improvement of the variance.
It's the same as the energy. The percentage holds through the whole thing. No, variance grow exactly because of the same reason as the energy grows. But as a percentage wise,
the relative energy variance divided by energy squared average.
Oh, I see. The Riemann's constant. That's right. That's Riemann's constant.
I have one question. Community of chemists has a big need of finding a database to accurate energy. So for example, brought the field extremely far, which brought actually DFT into chemistry, was that you had a very accurate so-called G1, G2, G3 database, where you had very accurate thermochemical data. Now in the organometallics, this is lacking. We don't have good experimental data. Is your accuracy such that you could get energies to reliably within a kilocal or two, let's say a tenth of an electron volt or better, for a number of organometallic systems? Because that would help benchmarking. Would avoid, for example, the problem that the chemists often run into, they benchmark against this sort of small inorganic database, and they just don't look, they fit their functions, for example, onto the database, and let's hold part of the chemistry which they basically are blind to, right?
I think that that's the right point. That's one of the things to which should be done. Exactly like it was in SP systems, G1, G2 set, something like that should be done. Whether we can do that within tenth of an electron volt, That remains to be seen.
I don't have the experimental numbers. I was thinking that a QMC could replace the experimental numbers for organic metals. Then we would have to have reliable QMC calculation within a tenth of an AD.
Yeah, well, we would love to do that, but it will take some time. So, and it's essentially the direction which where we are going. I do have here, I don't know, let's keep titanium oxygen molecule and things like that, but it's just the beginning. Yes?
I've become a little interested in cusp problems
mm-hmm.
the last few months. In quantum Monte Carlo, are you using wave functions that incorporate the cusp?
The exact cusp, yes, that's right.
So quantum Monte Carlo calculations, again, similar sense, could be used for benchmarking as far as cusp questions are
concerned. Absolutely. For that, in that respect, yes. Because we have actually exact cusps in there.
Are you sticking the cusp in, or are you getting it out?
No, we are putting it in variationally, directly variationally into the various form it's given in the exact, I mean the asymptotic form where two electrons go through each other, we have the exact form there.
This is not a result of QMC.
No, that's not a result. We actually want to put as much as possible inside because of course you improve the whole thing.
But you couldn't learn about the cost from QMC, right?
Well, you know it trivially from Schrödinger equation. It's a simple proof. There is no mystery in there.
No, but if your question is whether you could get it, you would, but it would take
money. Yeah, sure, but it would take a year to get out the density, especially when you have a singularity in there.
If you have them already sampling, then it's going to be much faster.
Well, specifically what I'm trying to do in a sensible way, these gradient methods, of course, do not include the cusp conditions, right? And so you want them. So they have an error that you actually know, so you want to remove it.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, we say that the cusps are one thing, and basically we say that they are already in our pocket in some sense, because we simply can sample anything what we didn't include into the wave function, we can sample. The problem is actually, and deep question for us is those boundary conditions. How they map with the types of the wave functions which you are using and with the physical effects which you are getting out.
Has there been any theoretical work on this fixed node? I've generally seen presentations not so different from yours, where one sees numbers, but one. That's not theory, right?
That's not theory, and that's not actually even, there is no rigorous statement here, it's just empirical evidence how it behaves.
You can prove that it's variational, there is
such a big... Variational, it's variational.
But a little more than, but that's obvious that it's variational.
Yeah, then you have...
If you make a small error that in the location that it's going to be... Together.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's obvious, but something about the coefficient of that.
Mm-hmm. Right now, there's almost nothing known about.
Almost nothing. There is
that doesn't seem terribly hard to me.
Oh, it is pretty. It is.
Well, if enough of you say it's very hard, I'll do it.
There are some general properties known, like a Teeling theorem, where we can say that for the local Hamiltonian U, there is essentially one non-reducible by permutations region, and all the wave function you can get just the permutations. And the proof is the same. There is the same argument as the Feynman's argument why the fermionic state is higher than the bosonic state. Because if they wouldn't be true, there would be an artificial node that costs energy, so it tries to make as big of a pocket as possible. That's pretty obvious. So that's the only thing which is pretty trivial. It doesn't help too much to do. There are methods which go beyond the fixed node, but they scale exponentially. For example, what you can do, you release the node for a short period of time. So you start to see the decay into the bosonic state, but at the same time the fermionic energy is recovered, right? And so you get a decrease in energy, but the error bars go exponentially. So for most cases, in the number of particles, it's exponential. For small systems, you can beat it to any type of accuracy. Actually, what is interesting, that already, do you know for which number of electrons QMC starts to win? Already for 3 electrons, it's more efficient than basis set methods. For 3 electrons, it is more efficient than basis set methods, you know, like a CI, whatever, copper cluster. The energy surface of H2 plus H to H plus H2 molecule, the reaction, was calculated by QMC by hundreds of a kilocal, and it was not just empty exercise. Some people in Caltech used it then for studying the Berry phase on the reaction surface, and for that you need such a big accuracy. So it was interesting that even those calculations are useful, even if the system looks fairly trivial, and it looked like an exercise in how to get the most out of the machine. Thank you for the attention. I'll be glad to respond on your questions.